Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.
Shrink Wrap Radio number 106, Psychology and the Coaching Movement, August 17, 2007. Welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio, the planet's premier psychology podcast. This is your host, Dr. Dave, coming to you from the San Francisco Bay Area. Shrink Wrap Radio is the show that speaks from the psychologist in me to the psychologist in you, whether you be amateur, student, or professional.
Help people achieve their goals and dreams. It's a counseling related field, but you don't have to go to a traditional school like I had been going to for the last 6 years and actually all my life. I was just enthralled with it, and it sounded too good to be true. I really thought it was some kind of pyramid scheme, multi-level marketing thing. Spent 8 months investigating it, and I did my research, and I went to local meetings of the International Coach Federation. I want to see, are there really people doing this? Are there really people making a living doing it? Can it really be as good as it seems?
That was the voice of Sarah Zeldman, who along with her husband, Dr. Alan Zeldman, are today's guests. The Zeldmans are Shrink Wrap Radio listeners who I've asked to step through the looking glass, transitioning from listeners to interviewees. Sarah Zeldman is a life and home business coach and the creator of SolutionsForBusyMoms.com. She has an AAS in sign language interpreting, a BA from the University of Rochester, and is a Coach U graduate. She has been a professional coach for 8 years. Alan Zeldman attended the University of Rochester, where he obtained his master's and a PhD in clinical psychology, specializing in addictions, human motivation, health psychology, and the psychology of religion. The focus of his doctoral dissertation was healthy and unhealthy motivations for religious behavior and their impacts on physical, emotional, and psychological well-being. He's published in numerous professional journals and books, such as the Journal of Health Psychology, as well as the British Journal of Addictions and the Journal of Social and Clinical Psychology. Much of his writing is focused on self-determination theory, and in his research and clinical work, he has interests in motivation as it applies to chronic illness, addictions, diabetes, weight loss, and religious behavior. Now, here's the interview. Sarah and Alan Zeldman, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, it's wonderful to have you here. I've invited the two of you because, Sarah, you have training and experience as a life coach, and Alan, you have training and experience as a clinical psychologist. And there are lots of questions about, well, what's the relationship between these two fields? And so that's something that we're going to be exploring over the course of our conversation together here. And so, Sarah, let's start with you. Why don't you tell us a bit about your schooling and how you got into coaching? Talking about, first of all, your academic schooling background and then how you got into coaching.
I got a BA from the University of Rochester. My major was comparative religion and a minor in American Sign Language. And I loved American Sign Language so much that I decided to go get another degree to become a sign language interpreter. But sign language interpreting is very taxing on the body. And I got a pretty severe case of repetitive stress injury. Carpal tunnel is a typical form of repetitive stress injury. And I went to doctors and therapists. And finally, 2 weeks before graduation, the physical therapist looked at me and said, "We think you should find another profession."
Interesting. That never occurred to me that signing would lead to repetitive stress. And I wonder if that's a problem for people who are deaf.
It's not the same in people who are deaf, because sign language interpreting is usually more formal, while conversations in sign language are more casual, and so it puts a different stress on the body. And also, often people who are deaf grow up signing, and so their body adapts to it.
Oh, okay.
So you have a high rate of repetitive stress injury in the sign language interpreting community, not nearly as much in the deaf community. Anyway, as you can imagine, when I was told 2 weeks before I graduated from this program, after 6 years of schooling, you know, between the BA and the interpreting degree, I was devastated, and I was like, oh gosh, please tell me I don't have to go to medical school or law school. I just couldn't take any more, schooling. And, for a nice Jewish girl, those seem to be the only two options.
Really? So, there's only law and medicine.
That's right. That's it. The physical therapist sent me to a career counselor, and when he heard my skills, he immediately recommended this new field of coaching. And when he described it, that you help people achieve their goals and dreams, it's a counseling-related field, but you don't have to go to a traditional school like I had been going to for the last 6 years and actually all my life, I was just enthralled with it. And it sounded too good to be true. I really thought it was some kind of pyramid scheme, multi-level marketing thing. And
right.
I spent 8 months investigating it. And I went to, did my research, and I went to local meetings of the International Coach Federation. I want to see, are there really people doing this? Are there really people making a living doing it? Can it really be as good as it seems? And anyway, and somewhere in there, I met my wonderful husband, and we married. And after we married, I started the Coach You training program.
Now, what did the coaching training program consist of? How long was it, and what was the curriculum like?
The program that I went to, it was 8 years ago, I have to tell you. So I don't remember. I mean, of course, I have all the skills. I don't remember, I don't have a detailed outline of the curriculum in my head. But we did, focus on, the basic skills to begin with of active listening and learn techniques like reframing situations and, basic goal achievements. We were also given lots of assessments to use with clients and taught to how to partner with people to help them achieve a new direction in their life or a particular goal that they want to achieve.
Now, was this training in person? Like, were you attending in-person classes, or was it online or phone conferences? How was it delivered?
All over the phone. All of the classes were over the phone. And the school is based over the internet, and I thoroughly enjoyed it.
And in fact, a lot of the coaching services are delivered over the phone, from what I understand.
80 to 90% of it, yeah. That is the way that coaching is practiced today.
Yeah, interesting. So how did you feel about the program that you went through? Did you feel that you got good training, that it was adequate?
I do. I really think it was a good preparation. I could have done it in 3 years if I took the four courses, the maximum four courses at the time. I could have taken it in a year and a half. I did it in 3 years. I do think it was adequate. I could always learn more, of course, and there are continuing education courses. And I'll be totally honest with you. They now have a core competency training program, which I think might be as little as 6 weeks. And I've seen coaches come out of there, and, even I, who is here to represent, the coaching profession and be very proud of it, do question what that curriculum is like and if that is enough, because I feel like those 3 years that I spent were, beyond adequate, but, just the beginning.
Yeah, so you're a bit skeptical of the six-week wonder.
I am. But I also do, I have not gone through it, and I do trust Coach University that they are committed to quality. So while I am concerned about those shorter training programs, I wouldn't totally write them off either without exploring them further.
Okay. Can you give us a little history on the field of coaching?
Sure. The field of coaching, in its modern form, to my knowledge, was largely developed and created by a man named Thomas Leonard. And Thomas was originally a financial advisor, but he realized that when people were asking him for financial advice, he was also helping them plan many aspects of his life, of their lives. And I think he originally called coaching life planning, but in the end, he opted for the term coaching because he thought of himself as similar to an athletic coach, like a coach for the game of life. And so in 1992, he founded Coach University, And it trained people who want to be coaches through teleclasses. That's the one I attended. About the same time, a woman named Laura Whitworth founded the Coach Training Institute in San Francisco, which trains coaches through a series of weekend workshops and then follows up with training by telephone. So those are the two oldest institutions in the coaching profession. And, you know, they teach a little bit differently. And then in 1996, Thomas created the International Coach Federation, which is arguably the professional organization for coaches. In my experience, that is the one that most coaches are members of and hold in the highest regard, although there are others that have formed. And the International Coach Federation now has about 10,000 members, if not more. So, you know, coaching is a very young profession, you know, and it has just about the same features as any profession in its infancy. And, you know, but because it's so young, I have found many therapists have reactions to it, ranging from, you know, legitimate concerns to outright ridicule and dismissal of it, you know, which is why we're here today.
Yeah, well, we'll get into that some more a little bit later. And also, we'll come back and I want to ask you a little bit about what experience you've had as a coach, you know, how your career is shaping up, the kind of people you've been working with, the kind of people you want to work with, where you want to take this. But I think we need to get your husband, Alan, into the conversation.
Sounds
here.
Good.
Are you still with us, Alan?
I'm still here.
Great. I'm glad to hear it. Alan, let's have you talk a bit about your background and what drew you to clinical psychology.
Sure. I think I recall my earliest interest in this field when I guess I was in high school, and my older brother was in university, and he was taking some psychology courses, and I remember picking up a couple of his textbooks and just thumbing through them and developed an interest in the field in general. I started to read the more popular side of psychology, magazines like Psychology Today, etc., which were, I guess, were just at my level at that point in time. But I think it really was in high school that I did start to develop an interest and almost made a decision that psychology was what I wanted to go into, and from the counseling side of it. I wasn't sure if psychology or psychiatry was more appealing. I was kind of interested in both. So when it came time to go to university, I did my undergrad in psychology. And immediately took some research assistantship jobs over the summer. And wasn't really sure. I also had, again, this interest in psychiatry, also some interest in medicine. And I remember at the end of my undergraduate, and I had planned on applying to graduate schools in clinical psych, I'd also apply to a medical school, and I remember I received a phone call for an interview to one of the medical schools, and I really wasn't sure what I wanted to do. I got a phone call that I was going to get an interview. This wasn't an admission, just for an interview. But then a couple of days later, I got a call from the University of Rochester, having applied there, that I got an interview there as well. And I had to make a decision that I want to go the medical route in psychiatry or stick to psychology. At that time, I felt very fortunate in that I was keeping some close company with a well-known psychologist, David Backham. And he had got me interested in motivational psychology a little bit, and I started to become interested in the works of Ed Deasy and Rich Ryan, and Ed's work on self-determination theory, and so that's where I applied to the University of Rochester, where Ed and Rich were working, and ended up interviewing for there, and that's how I landed at the University of Rochester and ended up doing my PhD there.
Okay, now, self-determination theory, actually, that's a new one on me. Can you give us kind of a very capsule summary of what that's about?
Sure. Ed Deasy basically developed the theory, I think one way to put it is, in reaction to what was dominant in the field at the time in the early 1970s of a more of a kind of Skinnerian approach and a learning approach to psychology. And he believed much more in people's will and interest in things as motivating forces rather than them simply being reactionary beings.
It sounds like he and I would be on the same page then.
Right. I mean, it certainly is an organismic approach to the individual, and he developed the field of self-determination theory based on some basic premises of the human being, that there's an innate kind of striving for autonomy, competence, and relatedness.
Mm-hmm.
I guess what you might call the three pillars of self-determination theory. So in a nutshell, that's kind of where it came from. Like I said, it was somewhat of a reaction to what he saw as a strong Skinnerian learning approach to the human individual, and at the same time, this notion that he felt there was an innate need for autonomy, competence, and relatedness, and developed in I think his first paper was 1972, his first series of experimental studies on how to assess individual interest and autonomy. And one of the major distinctions that is used in self-determination theory is the distinction between internal versus external interest.
Yeah, all of those ideas certainly resonate with me, and I think I'm familiar with them in other guises, but was not aware of his work. Is he still around? Maybe he'd make a good guest down
Ed
the line.
Ed is absolutely still around. Ed and Rich are still at the U of R, and it was really a pleasure to do my PhD under them. Rich was my direct advisor and also supervised much of my clinical work. So really a pleasure to work under both of them.
Okay, now how long have you been out of school?
Let's see. I've been out of school for about 3 years now.
Okay, and what are you doing clinically now?
When I first left school, I started working. I got a job at for the government doing data analysis. So what I have been doing up until now is doing had a data analytic job for the government and seeing clients in the evenings. So that was my main clinical work. And now I'm looking at developing more of just a clinical practice and stepping away from the non-clinical work. I'm interested in building, hopefully, a successful full-time practice. Right now, it's just part-time. And potentially in the future, I'm interested in the training side of psychology. It's one thing that is lacking in Canada right now, and specifically in Ontario, are training centers for new psychologists coming out of school. They don't have places to do their internships and practicums, etc. So it would really be a pleasure to turn a practice into a supervision and training site as well.
Are you in Canada now?
Yes. In Toronto.
I don't know why I thought you guys lived in Philadelphia. I thought I was calling Philadelphia.
No, we're in Toronto.
Okay, well, great. It's an international call then. Well,
right.
Sarah, let's bring it back to you now. Tell us a bit about, you know, what you did after you graduated from the coaching program. How has your coaching practice shaped up? What kinds of people and issues did you deal with?
Well, as most people who are not going directly into business coaching, I started out, I guess you would say, as a generalist, getting my feet wet, taking coaching clients, helping them to achieve certain goals, but and working with a mentor coach, so that I was supervised in that process. But as time went on, I narrowed down the people that I really wanted to work with, and at first it was it has really come to two different or two related areas. One being just women in general and the issues that women, particularly mothers, face in terms of creating balance and order and having more energy for their very, very busy lives. As a woman and often as a mother, I just find that women very often lose touch with themselves because we're so busy taking care of other people. And as a coach, I can help facilitate that process of, getting back in touch with, you know, parts of who they were before they became a mother or a caretaker in whatever way that they are, and then helping them create a plan to you know, bring some of that back into their life or go in a different direction. And so that's really, you know, general life coaching that I do with women. But I also really have developed another passion for helping women specifically to create successful, fulfilling home businesses and balance it with the rest of their busy lives. I just found that as I was coaching and I was narrowing my scope down to women with certain issues, a lot of my clients ended up also having businesses. And as I was learning to market my own business, I was teaching them the skills that they needed to learn how to market and create an effective, streamlined business. And I just I actually call myself a life and home business coaching. And most of the coaching that I do is really more home business related. But of course, you know, the life issues come in too. So you can't really separate them.
Well, I guess there, you know, what you've said suggests that there are different varieties of coaching or different specializations. I'm aware, you know, we all know about sports coaching, so we'll set that over to the side. But I've heard of executive coaching. I've heard of something called life coaching. What are some of the other varieties?
You will find many, many flavors of coaching.
Yeah.
Career coaching, relationship coaching, financial coaching, transition coaching for people in various transitions of their lives, health and wellness coaching, parent coaching, there are people who are doctoral thesis coaching. There are people who coach, you know, the students to get that.
A lot of need for that. Boy, I could have used that at a certain point.
Coaching for people for mothers with ADD or for entrepreneurs with ADD. There are as many coaches, you know, almost as you can dream of. So I named just a few, but I think you get the idea. People tend to really find something that they have some knowledge about and have a real passion for and coach in that area.
You're reminding me too of Martin Seligman started a program. I don't know if they call it happiness coaching or something like that, you know, that grew out of his work in positive psychology. So there's that variant as well. So, Sarah, do you have a war story or a success story that would help exemplify either the challenges or the successes of what you've been doing?
Oh, boy. Let me think. You know, I'm thinking back to one of my first clients one of my first really long-term clients that just made so many changes so quickly, but of course it's not instant, but in such a, you know, good period of time. And I just remember the first moment where I really felt like she was stuck in this low-paying job as the director of an international art guild, and it wasn't even about the money. She just didn't want to do it anymore. It wasn't the direction she wanted, but she wanted to go in. She felt so obligated, and they helped her out when she needed it, and they, you know, and they did this for her, and they did that for her. And I just remember this moment when I said, okay, Marion, when you're ready to stop being a slave, give me a call. And that was just, you know, and the next day, she, you know, I think I used the word indentured servant, you know, and the next day she resigned and she never looked back, and it was just the right move for her. I just heard in her so much how this was wrong for her in so many ways, and it was holding her back from moving in the direction she wanted to go. And, you know, while that may have been a bit directive, it was completely what I heard in her, and she just needed that coach as the catalyst to reflect it back to her, and she took movement, I think she does not regret it in the slightest, and she made a lot of other improvements as well.
Well, that's great. And do you find that that tends to be typical? Have you been able to be there as a facilitator for other people to make critical movement ahead in their lives?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I remember, and it's funny the way that it can happen. I remember, just a client being perpetually late and me having a discussion with them about boundaries. And the next day she said, you know what? I was talking about boundaries. We were talking about boundaries and you're right. And I told my alcoholic husband that he cannot, live here anymore until he deals with this. So I was like, we didn't even talk about your husband,
know?
I mean, that's an example of the relationship itself, but the lessons, the things that we talk about in coaching can, really make a difference in people's lives. I mean, and I particularly enjoy seeing success in women's businesses as well, and helping them streamline their practice that way. And, right now I'm helping a marital therapist, fill his practice. And he happens to be one of my few male clients, but as his practice grows, it's just, really rewarding to know that he has the marketing tools in place now. And to be that sounding board for ideas and for preparation, it's just really, really wonderful.
Okay, well, now we come to the juicy part, potentially, here, of looking at the interface between these two disciplines, these two different, very different sets of trainings, and yet clearly there overlap in terms of the issues that are being dealt with. For example, Sarah, when I heard you talking about confronting this one woman on the boundary issue, that could have been a therapist talking about a therapy session. So here we have a therapist, we have a coach. You guys, you must have some interesting or have had some interesting conversations about these issues over the dinner table or elsewhere.
Certainly. I mean, I don't know, Sarah. Do you want to take that?
Well, we haven't heard from you in a bit, Alan. So why don't you start off with it, Alan?
Sure. I mean, I think that throughout my training and when I was in graduate school and since leaving and seeing clients now, there have been many, many times when I've actually asked for Sarah's input on some of my clients and some of the issues they're struggling with, because she does have some very good clinical skills, which I think come out in her coaching work. And there's no question that there are many similarities between the two fields. I mean, you have this basic notion of a person. If I think about, let's say, the work of Jerome Frank and the way he describes the typical patient, because what's common across all patients is that they have struggled with some issue for some period of time and made a decision that they are no longer, that they cannot, rise to the occasion. They're not able to succeed in some area or deal with some difficulty that they're facing, and they decide to seek outside help. And so that is, the common trait of all patients, as Jerome Frank describes it. So I think you would find the same feature or the same trait among coaching clients. And the question becomes, does the person, the client, need something that is more clinically oriented or something that is more coaching oriented? And so certainly many of the discussions Sarah and I have had have been around, times maybe where she would be describing for, to me what work she may be doing with a particular client. And I might have a pretty strong response sometimes and say, those are real therapy issues. It sounds to me like that's, what you're talking about is depression. What you're talking about is something more pathological than a coaching issue. So I think that's where some of the tensions, I think, start to come out when you see the overlap between the client's needs.
Well, Sarah's lucky to have a clinical psychologist consultant close at hand to give her that feedback. What do you think about if we pull back and look at it from, the two different professions? How do you feel as a clinical psychologist who I assume went through years of training, mm-hmm. you know, to get a PhD in clinical psychology. And then these coaches, we will depersonalize it from Sarah in particular, coaches who are going through a course of study, you know, that is a lot less intensive and much briefer and maybe over the telephone.
Right.
How should psychology be regarding this?
Pardon me?
How should psychology be regarding this, do you think?
Well, I think, I mean, the concern I think is always there that there are people that will go to a coach and seek out the advice and counsel of a coach when in fact they may need a therapist. And the risk that the coach may not see it, the coach may not have the background in their training to recognize psychopathology, to recognize illness, and therefore kind of refer the person in the right direction, so to speak. You know, in much the same way, I may have a client who I feel when they come and we have our first session, I might feel that, well, given my background and my training, they would do better with a different therapist, someone who specializes in their particular difficulty. But it also may be the case that the referral might be to someone who's a coach because they're not presenting really any pathology. They're just looking for help and something that coaching may be able to do. But the risk is there that clients will go and see a coach. Individuals will go and seek out the help of a coach when in fact a therapist is what they need at that time in their lives. And the question becomes, are coaches trained to recognize that? Is there a process involved? Is there something in the training of a coach that kind of allows them to recognize and facilitates their recognition of the patient versus the client?
I'd like to speak to that if I can. Yes, this was a subject that was drilled into us in the coach training program, that you are not a therapist under any circumstances. You shall not attempt therapy. Thou shalt refer to a therapist when appropriate. And we were discussed how to screen for clients who might need therapy, or how to recognize when therapy issues come up in the course of coaching and when it's appropriate to refer a client to a therapist. You know, of course, I can't speak for people who call themselves coaches without any training, but I can tell you that this is an issue in coach training programs that is directly addressed in no uncertain terms, that doing any kind of psychotherapy is not kosher.
Well, that assumes that we know the difference between coaching and psychotherapy, and I'm not sure if there's a firm boundary there or not. What do you see as the difference between coaching and counseling or therapy?
Well, I see the difference between coaching. There are four main differences in coaching and between coaching and psychotherapy. First of all, is a basic assumption about the consumer, right? The consumer in therapy is patient, and the consumer in coaching is a client. And the patient is usually suffering from symptoms and needs an expert, the medical expert, to, you know, help them alleviate the symptoms, such as anxiety or depression. And it's a very, you know, medical view of the consumer. And in coaching, the primary assumption is that the client is emotionally healthy and high functioning and doesn't need a cure so much as desires a structured relationship to achieve a certain outcome. So that's one thing, is the basic assumptions about the consumer. Another area where it differs is the roles within the relationship. Now, all these ways are related, but they are slightly different. So the role within the relationship is that the coach is not the expert or the doctor who diagnoses a pathology or applies a treatment, but is a partner who has the skills to help facilitate the client's, you know, achievement of a certain goal, or even the discovery of what that goal should be, before they even create a plan to achieve it. But in therapy, there's a very clear doctor-patient relationship, and the bottom line is that the doctor is the expert in mental health. The goal of the relationship, again, is different. The goal of a therapy relationship is to be therapeutic. You know, therapy involves the diagnosis and treatment of pathology, and the goal is often to alleviate symptoms of mental illness or other symptoms that impede a person's ability to function in a normal manner. And in short, we don't go there. We know we shouldn't go there. The goal of the coaching relationship is achievement. And we measure success not by alleviating symptoms, but by producing results. And sometimes, those results may be internal as well as external, like shifts in awareness or patterns of thinking, or emotional states which inspire confidence. But those internal results have to be accompanied by external results for coaching to be considered a success. And the other difference is that the coaching process is focused on the present and the future. And while you may argue that certain schools of psychology also focus on the present and the future, in general, when people think about what therapy is, their first association is sitting in a room talking with someone else about their childhood or about their past. Coaching asks questions about how to, and therapists tend to ask questions about why. So those are the four, as I see it, the four major differences between coaching and psychology.
Okay, well, that's an excellent reply. And in this conversation, I'm playing a bit of the devil's advocate here. So I'm going to play the bad guy. And, a lot of what you've described, actually, psychotherapists would say would apply to them. As you indicate, most of the psychotherapists I know no longer refer to their, quotes, consumers as patients, but rather refer to them as clients, for example. So that's not a unique differentiator. And certainly a lot of therapists do, as you've indicated, work, focus more in the present and aren't so willing to go into excursions in the past. That's more associated with the psychodynamic and more historical fields of psychotherapy, or schools of psychotherapy, rather. So, I get the gist of what you're saying, and I buy the gist of what you're saying, but at the same time, I have to say the boundaries are not really so neat and clear as one might hope for. And then there's the whole issue of psychology's vested interests, turf wars.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly there is a whole history of turf wars in the larger mental health, social welfare field. First, you have psychiatry, and so psychiatry wants to be king of the hill. And along comes clinical psychology. And so there were hard-fought battles for a number of years, and I'm not sure that they're completely over with, even today, about, what are the prerogatives of clinical psychology versus psychiatry? And right now, the main one is the ability to prescribe medication. And, of course, there are psychologists who are advocating for that, and even some states, I think, in which it's being explored. Then along come, social work is actually an old profession and pretty well established and was on a parallel track. But then along comes counseling as a separate discipline with a somewhat separate his overlapping in some ways with psychology, but also having its own history, much like the coaching movement. I think both kind of spring out of a sort of vocational advising sort of situation, although in different historical contexts. I hope I'm not rambling on too long here. I want to give it back to you guys at some point. But so So then there were, like in the state of California, for example, I remember there used to be a license that people could get as pastoral counselors. So people would, let's say they go to a Gestalt weekend, a Gestalt therapy weekend at Esalen, and feel like, hey, this is great stuff, and now I know how to do it. And so they might join the Universalist church, you know, that you could get ordained through the mail for a couple of bucks, and you'd get a certificate saying you were ordained, and then you could go to the state and you could get a license as a pastoral counselor. And there were lots of people doing that who had, you know, very little formal training in terms of being counselors or therapists or anything else. Well, that evolved to where there were then began to be the marriage and family counseling field began to emerge, and there were turf wars there vis-a-vis psychology and psychiatry. But the MFTs, they won the day, and there's a two-year training that's quite rigorous, and I'm licensed as both a psychologist and as an MFT in California. And, of course, it took a lot longer to get the training and the licensing to be a psychologist. And, frankly, there are no additional privileges. There's no point, really, in my being licensed as a psychologist over and above being licensed as a counselor. Now there's another group pressing in called the licensed professional counselor, I think it's being called, and that lowers the bar to entry a little bit more. There's something in California called the master hypnotist or master hypnotherapist. What a great marketing ploy that was. Mm-hmm. That your license that you get from the state says you're a master hypnotherapist, and it's a rather cursory training. I don't know all the details, but basically, I think you need a BA and then some number of hours of some course, you know, that you take somewhere, and then you get this and you're a master hypnotherapist. So there are going to be professional turf wars, I think. I don't know. Have you heard of any turf? I mean, if I were in private practice, which I'm not, and if I were of a different nature than I am, because I'm fairly broad and accepting in my nature, so I'm not too threatened by this, but I could imagine therapists who's working hard, like Alan, say, starting out, trying to build a practice, and some percentage of your potential business, Alan, might be getting siphoned off by coaches.
Certainly, and again, you know, siphoned off by some of these other professions that you've mentioned. It certainly does go on, and I think that one of the ways in which psychologists are trying to address it is not so much from the perspective of you know, protecting their income and protecting their security and the stability of their practice, as much as they're concerned about are there people out there that need help and aren't getting it because someone else is pretending to be the helper when they don't have the training behind them that they need? And there's always the question, which of course has been, you know, addressed within psychology itself for many, many years, which is, you know, does it work? And so, you know, of course we have all these efficacy studies within psychology, and, you know, if we look at all the meta-analytic studies, we can, you know, boil it all down and say, well, overall, therapy works. It's successful about, you know, 66% of the time. And if you try to compare the different types of therapy, you know, and I've, you know, heard this on, you know, on your shows as well, people discussing this issue of, you know, different types of therapy and what works and what doesn't mm-hmm. work. Well, the evidence seems to show that there really isn't any difference. Basically, it's about 65% across the board, and it doesn't matter if it's a psychodynamic therapist or a cognitive behavioral therapist or humanistic, it really doesn't make a difference. So we kind of know in psychology what's working, what isn't, and as has been shown in the research, and I'm not sure, I can't remember exactly some of your guests that have talked about it. But
Scott D. Miller is the one to listen to.
Miller, right.
Yeah.
Well, the main feature that seems to be the distinguishing factor seems to be the therapist themselves and the relationship that is developed between the therapist and the patient. The question, I think, when it comes to coaching is, do we have any data that says that it works? And how do we define that it has worked? How do we define that there has been a successful outcome? You know, I am not personally aware of studies that have been done on coaching. And the question, of course, is also there of, well, just how do we assess it? What is the measurement tool?
Well, I could speak to that about the lack of scientific data. There is not much, but keep in mind how young the profession is, and the field of psychology was also young at one point as well, without data as well, but that didn't mean that it wasn't legitimate or didn't have great potential. The International Coach Federation does have a research and education committee, which is committed to, among other things, increasing the knowledge base of the science of coaching and contributing to the advancement of coaching theory and best practices. You can find a bibliography of published coaching research at their website. You'll find articles from consulting psychology journals, the Journal of Marital and Family Therapists, the Journal of American Academy of Psychoanalysis, and among others. So there is research being done. There's not a lot of it yet, and I'll admit it does not seem to be the focus of many individual coaches that I know, but then again, we don't have training in that kind of research that psychologists have training in. So that is the scoop on the research.
Yeah, okay.
Just to go to the original point, that there definitely is, threat may be too harsh of a term, but a sense that there are people there that are potential patients and would be in need of some of the things that a well-trained therapist could give them, but that for some reason, either by the solicitations of a coach or by happenstance, that is where they find themselves. And depending on the coach themselves, that may be where they stay.
I will not disagree with that. I think it's a very real concern for therapists that that the coaching field serves to narrow their market. And, you know, while I've made the distinctions between coaching and therapy as clear as I can, there are obviously many people who are going to fall into a gray area where they're high functioning, and they could go either way. And before the development of coaching, many people would have gone to a therapist, but now they have the option of coaching, and they may pick coaching. You know, maybe I'm an optimist, and I in part think that there's enough business for everyone. I also think that coach training programs do teach us that we're not therapists and need to refer to, therapy patients to therapy. There seems to be this underlying assumption that coaches want to lure potential patients away from therapists. And I really think it's the opposite. Any coach who is trained is not only taught that that is unethical, but is taught that it's not worth your time, because a client who really needs therapy is not coachable and will not make progress. So, I understand where the concern comes from, but once you get to know the coaching profession, I think you'll find out that we're not out to get your clients. And I think that the reason why we're here today is to start opening up that dialogue. I think that coaches, it would be great if on an individual level, coaches had psychologists as consultants and referral partners, and vice versa, as, Aaron and I seem to do for each other.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that's happening, in fact, is that some psychotherapists, some people with traditional psychotherapy training or counselor training, are starting to move into coaching. And they're preferring to call themselves coaches, because in fact there is a certain attraction and luster to the coach model, that it's not as scary for people to decide to go see a coach. You don't have to admit that you, quotes, need help, or that, quotes, you're having a problem. It doesn't carry the same stigma that I think seeing a therapist continues to carry for many people.
Yeah, absolutely. And I find that the coaches who do go, the therapists who do go to become coaches usually go through a training program. And they're probably, you know, if you wanted to do a follow-up show, might be a great people to ask about the clearer distinction between coaching and therapy and how that actually plays out in their practice. I know of, you know, a therapist who does both, but you don't use both modalities with one client. If you start out as a coach with a client, you stay as their coach. If you start out as a therapist, you tend to stay in that therapist, as a therapist there. I do want to address, if it's okay, one thing that I've been wanting to say from a few minutes ago, is that for as much as I have told you that we were taught, you know, the distinction between coaching and therapy and to greatly respect the need for therapy where it's appropriate, I do think, I will admit, that I think training could be even better than it is in this area. And I think that, you know, one of the things I would like to see happen in creating more of a dialogue between the coaching field and the psychology field is that coaching could learn to use established mental health assessments to help screen clients even better than we do now. You know, to have a client take a standard assessment for depression, anxiety, suicidality could really only benefit coaches and therapists. It could help save the coach's time and energy, you know, and help the client get what they really need.
Well, that's a great suggestion. I'm now envisioning the Sarah and Alan Zeldman School of Coaching, in which these, based in Toronto, Canada, and people are flocking from around the world to study with you. You know what? We're kind of running out of time here, so I really want to thank the two of you for being willing to engage in this discussion with me. And I wonder if there are any final words that you'd like to say as we wrap things up here. Sarah, I know you've got a website you might want to tell people about.
Go ahead, Sarah.
Okay. You know, I guess my final thought is that I think that coaches have a lot to learn from psychologists, and psychologists can also learn a few things from coaches. And the bottom line is, we're here to stay. We're not going away.
Okay.
So, you know, I would love to see us learn from each other and work together on an individual and on an organizational level. So that said, that's my real intention of coming on the show today. And that said, if anyone wants to learn more about me, you can visit my website at solutionsforbusymoms.com.
And I'll put a link to that on the website. And Alan, your final words?
Well, I wanted to thank you for the opportunity to present, I guess, what might be described as both sides of the coin here. I do think that, you know, as Sarah mentioned, you know, there are therapists now that are being trained as coaches. So certainly I think the therapists are doing that. I don't think from a feeling of threat, rather seeing the merits in coaching and what it has to offer and what it can bring to the table that therapy might not. So hopefully this is only one in a series of dialogues that might take place around the world where people see that these are two fields that certainly can enhance one another and that as a whole can really help an individual more as a whole and look not only at pathology but also the ways in which they can be bettered. Not from a position of necessarily illness, but also from a position of wellness.
I totally agree. Sarah and Alan Zeldman, thanks so much for being my guests today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you very much, David.
It is such a pleasure. Thanks.
Okay, we did it.
Woo!
Woo! Woohee! So who's watching the kids?
Oh, no, the kids. There it kept. You know, could you imagine our poor kids, the children of a psychologist and a life coach?
Hey.
Think about it.
Yeah.
You know? Isn't that scary? How do you feel about that, honey? Who cares how he feels? Let's make an action plan.
Yeah, there you go. All right. Okay, well, this was fun, and I hope it was fun for you, too.
Sure, yes, it was.
It was great, and I really thank you for the opportunity. I love your podcast, and I listen to them all the time, and I just never thought I'd be on. Wow.
I hope you enjoyed this interview with Sarah and Alan Zeldman. I'm always aware that some portion of my audience is either considering a career change or is just starting out. I think lots of people have a sense that they want to work with others and that they would be skilled in doing so. Midlife adults in particular are sometimes looking for a career change but can't afford to take the time away from their present job or supporting their family to return to a regular university course of study. And I think the whole coaching phenomenon is very interesting, and I'm not against it. As long as people get good training, have a good sense of the limits of their expertise, have a sense of what's appropriate for them and what's not appropriate for them to offer, and as long as they possess some native talent. Because I think some people are just natural-born healers, inspirers, motivators, etc. And that's not always something that can be really taught. And as I mentioned in the interview, I know that there are mental health professionals who have transitioned into coaching. I think probably it's because it's such an au courant thing, and partly because they look forward to working with healthier, maybe easier to work with populations, and because it's based on an educational model rather than a medical model. I know a lot of mental health professionals are not comfortable with the kind of stigmatizing approach of the DSM. I do have some difficulty, though, envisioning folks straight out of college or university going into this sort of coaching, that is, with a bachelor-level degree. I think it would take some life experience and, ideally, to me, some expertise in the domain within which they're coaching. Now, not everyone would agree with me on this last point. Some in the coaching field argue that it's not necessary to have been an executive oneself to be an executive coach. But if I were an executive seeking coaching, I think I'd want someone who's been in the trenches. Now, I found an excellent article on the web about coaching and counseling. It's on a coach's website at www.julietaustin.com. That's JulietAustin.com. And in talking about the future of coaching, they make some interesting points. They write, "As the coaching profession continues to evolve, several trends are likely to become more obvious. One, for the consumer, the availability of coaches will mean a change in the way some people seek support, especially those clients outside of employee assistance programs and agencies. Two, some of the distinctions between therapy and coaching will be made more explicit and will become increasingly clear to the public. People will know when they want to seek therapy or coaching. Some U.S. regulatory boards, for example, Colorado, that licensed therapists have suggested that coaching fits under the definition of therapy. This could cause problems for coaches who are not licensed therapists in those states. Organizations like the ICF, that's the organization that Sarah mentioned, and many therapists who are now coaches are addressing these issues, attempting to sort them out. Three, an increasing number of therapists will receive coach training and offer coaching services instead of or in addition to their therapy services. Four, training programs for coaching will increasingly be developed in academe. The University of Sydney in Australia is developing a coaching psychology program. Five, more sophisticated models of coaching will continue to emerge, incorporating theories and concepts from psychology and therapy. Six, coaches perhaps will be required to have training in assessment for depression, suicide, abuse, and even grief counseling so they know both when to appropriately refer clients for therapy and what to do in order to avoid risking lawsuits. That's an area we didn't get into that I meant to bring up. Currently, psychologists and psychiatrists pay a lot of money for insurance to protect them if they get sued. I wonder if any coaches have been sued or are thinking about that they might get sued. And their final point, seven, therapists are likely to refer to coaches more often once their clients reach a place where they are ready to take more action or achieve excellence in their lives. Coaches will increasingly refer a client to therapy when the client seems inappropriate for coaching or gets stuck on an issue that is not being resolved in coaching." So that's it, sports fans. Get back in the game and score one for Dr. Dave.
on the couch again with Dr. Dave. And shrink wrap radio is playing on again. Yeah. It's all in your head. It's all in your head. Shrink wrap radio. Shrink wrap radio. Shrink wrap radio. Shrink wrap radio. It's shrink wrap radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head.
Well, you know, I have to tell you, I was starting to think that maybe our Frapper map was broken, or that it had peaked and topped out and nobody could add themselves. But I'm happy to announce we have one new addition. So a hearty welcome to Bay, who is from Xinhua, Zhejiang, China. But she indicates that she's listening in Australia, so I suspect, Bei, that maybe you're a student. And she writes, thanks for the quality hours. Well, thank you. And I'm so glad that you signed up on the Frapper map and have reassured me that it's still working. Well, this is my first recording on my new iMac. I've got the top-of-the-line 24-inch monitor, 2-point-something gigahertz, 500-gigabyte hard drive, 2 gigabytes of RAM, iMac, and it is beautiful and a real pleasure to work with. Speaking of technical stuff, if you're listening to the show but not subscribed, as I said before, please do subscribe. It costs nothing. And on the right-hand side of each page at shrinkwrapradio.com, there's an icon that says subscribe in iTunes. And all you do is click on that, and it leads you through the steps. And speaking of iTunes, as I mentioned last time, we saw our biggest jump in listeners back when iTunes featured us on their podcast page. Still, nobody else has put another review there, but it's the reviews on iTunes that I think triggers getting featured there. So if you have not submitted a review, and so many of you have written such wonderful feedback, if you would just put some of that feedback very succinctly and very positively in an iTunes review, that would be a big help. Well, I just made a sobering discovery. I tried going to my Shrink Wrap Radio website because I wanted to tell you about the poll, and I see that it is not displaying properly on this Intel-based Mac in Safari. It does display okay in other browsers like Firefox. So I hope none of you are having this experience, and hopefully Apple will fix something soon. That being said, we're still running this poll that asks, should the American Psychological Association write its code of ethics to forbid psychologists to be involved in military prisoner interrogation? And so far, only 18 people have voted, but 67% have said yes, and 22% no, and 11% undecided. So get in and cast your vote. I'm going to leave it up a while longer. The APA convention is this weekend. I'm going to go for at least part of the time. I know tomorrow morning at 8 in the morning is a symposium on this very question, but I live about 2 hours away. I don't think I'm going to get up early enough to make it, to tell you the truth. By the way, speaking of the poll, I put out a call to you listeners to contribute some good questions for the poll, and I got a number of great questions from Lloyd in Australia. So, Lloyd, thanks a lot for that, and I think you'll see some of those questions appear as time goes by in the future. And so let me once again thank our sponsors, GoDaddy and Podshow. And remember, if you use the checkout code SHRINK3 at checkout, you can get a healthy discount at GoDaddy.com.
Hi, Dr. Dave. This is Nir from New York calling, enjoying your programs tremendously, and I'm having fun listening to my own music playing there also. And I just finished listening to the Anne is a Man program. a guy that has an Israeli wife, and it's really touching base with me, since I'm Israeli myself and my wife as well. Anyway, thank you so much again, and hope we'll keep in touch. Thank you. Bye.
Nir, thanks for that. It's good to hear from you again. I'm glad, and I know Anne and his wife will be glad to know that the interview connected with another Israeli, even if he is living in New York City. And Nir, I don't thank you enough for the music you and your friend gave me for both this and the Wise Counsel podcast. I'm running long again, so I'll take time for just a couple of recent emails. Last time I wondered aloud if anyone was listening to the show from an iPhone. Well, at least one person is. I received the following from, I don't know if it's pronounced Analia or Analia, but she writes, and I assume it's a she, "Dr. Dave, I wanted you to know that I'm a big fan of your show and a big fan of listening to your show from the iPhone. I couldn't resist to buy the day it came out. Keep the great episodes coming." And then she sent me a follow-up. I asked her for a review, and she kind of gave me a review of the pluses and minuses of the iPhone. And she went on to say, "I really enjoy your interviews. I've listened to all your shows in both podcasts, Shrink Wrap Radio and Wise Counsel." That's what I call a loyal listener. "And I especially enjoy the ones on dreams. I'm not a mental health practitioner or student. I'm a photo retoucher living in New York, originally from Uruguay." And she says, "I can't enter myself in the Frapper map as from Uruguay because I don't listen to your show from there." That would be a first, too. "Thanks for the podcast. They are really informative. Talk to you soon, and let me know if you get your iPhone." Well, you can believe I'll let the whole world know. I sort of had a shot today to work a deal with a guy to swap contracts so that I could get an iPhone. But I decided to hold up a little bit longer. I have to say my BlackBerry works very well, so I may hold out a little longer. Well, I think there's time for just one more right now, and it comes from Budapest. Wow. "Dear Dr. Dave, just to say hello and how much I enjoy your podcast, which has become my addiction. I'm a psychotherapist who was educated in Belgrade, now living in Budapest and working here. I like your relaxed way of approaching people. I like your choices of subjects and your guests as well. Please continue. All the best, Vera." Vera, how exciting to hear from you off in Budapest. And I hope you'll write again and tell me more about yourself, and also maybe add yourself to our Frapper map. That better wrap it up for today in terms of email. You can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. You can leave voicemails on Skype. Our name there is ShrinkPod. You can also leave voice messages on MyChingo, and you'll find a link to that on our Shrink Wrap Radio website. And our voicemail phone is 206-337-0622. Once again, my thanks to Sarah and Alan Zeldman for their insights on the interplay between coaching and psychology. I'm not sure what's on for next week. Ideally, it will probably be a series of short interviews from the American Psychological Association convention in San Francisco, where I will be one of 14,000 psychologists in attendance, if you can believe that. That's it for now. This is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.